All right, so as you said, my name is Nick Edmonds. I'm the Director of Student Ministries and the Administration here at the Columbia Grove. And before we jump into things, I just want to say thank you to everybody here, how much you guys have invested in the youth, whether that's in the way of money or just nice words that you say to the youth or myself, because that encouragement is super needed. But not only that, but I can't do everything. And because I can't do everything, I have to raise up some leaders. And I have two exceptional leaders that have stepped up and have done some amazing things. So I just want to call them out real quick. If I could have Kaylee, and then Eric is in the back there. He's the kid who looks like he's in high school and has a really nice beard, but he's actually 21. That's him back there. He's our middle school leader. And then Kaylee is our high school leader, and I've been meeting with them, and they spearhead everything that I just don't have time for. November and December are the times that we are running those leaders through chaos. This month, just last weekend, we had a middle school lock-in. There were no deaths, there were no blood, so it was a success. Thank you. Go ahead and give them a round of applause. Next week is our high school lock-in. The weekend after that, we're doing a night in the box where we are meeting with all the other youth groups around the area, and we're sleeping in a box, and we're hearing testimonies of those that have been homeless. We're sharing a meal together. It's just a really good experience. And then we jump into December, which is the craziest time for any church, just about. So if you guys could give them a round of applause, whether it's the two main leaders or any of our leaders, that's fantastic. Also segueing into a disclaimer, because of the lock-in, I was really tired, and I've had 5 cups of coffee today, so if I'm like tweaking out up here, yeah, it's lack of sleep and caffeine. We're going to jump into Ephesians 3 here in just a minute, so if you guys have your Bibles, you can feel free to open that up. Otherwise, they'll be up there in just a second. Before I do that, though, I kind of wanted to tell you guys a little bit about who I am, where I come from, because if I'm going to be working in the church with your children, you should probably know what kind of weirdo I happen to be. And I use that word because it is so very true. I wasn't always this big, buff, good-looking stud that you see in front of you now. I actually started out life as this really skinny, awkward kid. My ears stuck out like satellite dishes, more so than they do now. I was the target of a lot of bullying, okay? And it was because of that I had to try to find my place and where I belonged. See, I had a really good personality. I fit in everywhere, but I didn't belong anywhere. I could go from group to group, and I could manage and bounce around from people, but it didn't really feel like I belonged there. It didn't feel like I had family or friends in those areas. So I spent a good portion of my middle school and high school years trying to figure out, like, who am I? What defines me? I was raised in the church, so I always had that kind of foundation of God's morals and what I'm supposed to do. But when you're in middle school and high school, it doesn't seem like those are super important sometimes, which is why I think I have a heart for youth. I want that passion to happen early before they get to become adults and they've made mistakes. Once I got into high school, I started to realize because I didn't fit in anywhere, I didn't really have anything. I didn't have anything to lose. I'm going to be the same weirdo, no matter you make fun of me here or you make fun of me there. If I mess up over here, I'm still the same weirdo. I just am what I am. So I needed to find out what defines me. Where do I belong? What can I do? And I found out that the best way to get attention is to do stupid things that people say you shouldn't do. So that started out with jumping off bridges into the water, which I have watched many people break their legs off the same bridge, but I'm apparently better than that, so I did it anyway. I went to growing this magnificent hairstyle here that is seared. There we go, the seal mullet right there. That is sealed in the high school yearbook. I cannot get rid of that. That's me, yes indeed. Someone said it was the most disgusting haircut, and I was like, I could probably do something like that. One day we were playing basketball for my freshman year, and I remember hearing some kids say, you know, it's really gross, dudes with pierced nipples. And so I said to myself, Yeah, I can do that. So I wound up doing that not once, not twice, but three separate times in my life. All because most of the time it fell in situations where I was trying to figure out where I belonged. Because I'd find out where I belonged and then I'd slip back. And then I'd find out where I belong and I'd slip back. And apparently that's how I dealt with that. I don't encourage any of that, see. When you don't know where you belong, you have to find something that is your God. You have to find something that is your identity. And so it wasn't until after high school that I decided to date one of my really good female friends. And because I didn't have anything else that directed me anywhere, I decided to make her, for lack of a better word, my idol or my God. And she is what gave me identity. She is where I put all my focus. And so when it came time for her to go off to college and move to Seattle, I wasn't sure I wanted the city life. I grew up in Kashmir, population 3,000, and that was just fine with me. But I moved to Seattle because she moved to Seattle because I didn't have any other identity. And we ended up dating for a total of just about 3 years, and it was a fantastic relationship. I think there were a lot of things that went right. But there's also a lot of things that go wrong when you don't make God the focus of those things. And after a while, because I put my identity in her, it took the struggle and put that weight on her shoulders. And that's one of the reasons that it failed. It also made it really hard for me to know who I was when she's mad at me. When God's mad at me, who am I? What do I do? And so after a while, we broke up. And I ended up moving back to Kashmir. I got a job at a meat department, and at first things were great because now I can go find a new girlfriend, because now I can go to parties and not feel guilty. There were just all these things that I could do, and it was awesome for about a month. I partied hard. I did all sorts of fun things. I was accountable to no one. But after a while, that lifestyle kind of, it sinks in, and the toll starts to weigh on you. And I started to let the drinking get a hold of me. And probably for about 4 months, alcohol was kind of my focus because the pain from not having that girlfriend in my life anymore hurt really bad. It wasn't just the breakup, that was where my identity was. If it was just a breakup and I knew who I was in that process, it would make it a lot easier. But I had no idea who I was. In fact, all I knew was I was nobody. And so I wake up and I drink. And I'd go to bed drunk. Some days I'd wake up and I'm still drunk from the night before and I'd go to work, which is a terrible idea when you're working in a meat department with knives and bandsaws. But I still have all my fingers, thank God. But it hit me hard. And I can remember one night, and this was the defining moment in my life when I can say this is where God came through for the very first noticeable time in my life. I was on the ground. I was angry. I started cussing at God, and I said, God, you either save me right now, or I'm giving up. Now, I don't know what giving up meant at that time. I was probably drunk and unaware of what I meant in those situations, but it could have meant taking my life. It could have meant I'm not going to try anymore. I'm going to sit here and become this bump on a log, which was pretty much what I was already doing. The very next day, word gets around that I'm not doing so well. So I have a friend whom I haven't seen for a while stop by. We are talking, and he says, hey, let's go see our friend Job. I haven't seen Job since high school, but I know his dad's a pastor. He's a pretty good Christian guy, and he's currently working at the Christian bookstore. So I was like, all right, I got nothing better to do. So we talk to him, and he invites me to college group, this place where there's people my age, and he says there's three things. And I only focused on two. He said there will be God, and I was like, eh, but there will be pizza. Oh, okay. And there will be girls. Okay, pizza and girls. I'm in. Count me in. So I showed up. I ate my pizza. I flirted with some girls. And I ended up staying because of God. He got a hold of me so hard. And it took a while. Like I said, I was raised Christian, so I had those embers burning inside of me, but the flames weren't there. It just was burning, but there was no evidence of any fire. But once God got a hold of me, that fire started to burn, and I realized I cannot just be somebody who shows up on Sunday or Thursday. I have to do something more with my faith. This church offered a 9-month internship where it was eat, sleep, breathe Jesus. We'd wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, go work out together. We'd go home, quickly eat, and then we started college classes, served in every area of ministry. And most days, it went from 6 o'clock in the morning till about 11 o'clock at night. It was about a 40 to 50 hour kind of thing. And I can tell you right here, right now, I have never felt so close to God in my entire life. Why? Because I didn't have time for anything else. I would read my Bible, I would serve with people around me, and that was so amazing. But when that fire first started to burn, I kind of got that annoying, I see it a lot with new youth, they get that annoying, like, hey, I'm a Christian, you shouldn't listen to that, it's got bad words, you shouldn't watch that because it's got this, and I just became uber religious, uber annoying, and people wanted to slap me. But luckily, when you're in a church family, you have people who can come beside you and start help guiding you a little bit to become not the immature Christian anymore, but somebody who's more solid in their faith, somebody who can walk with God. And that kind of became where I realized that as a kid, the reason I did those things, the reason I grew the mullet, the reason I did all the obnoxious things was because I was bold, but I was bold in myself. And now I have an opportunity to be bold in Christ. And even if I wasn't bold all the time, I can learn to be bold. And I realized at that point in time also that I was somebody who had nothing to lose. I was a kid who got picked on all the time. I didn't really feel like I belonged, so what are you going to take from me? And when I first became that Christian, I was in people's faces all the time. Although it was done incorrectly, it would be awesome if we had more people that were that bold, who could share that faith without being afraid of the repercussions. And so even today, I stand up here and I think about where I was in that internship. It's like, man, I want that fire back. Man, I'd love to feel that bold because I'm obnoxious, I'm awkward. Sometimes that's because I'm serving myself. Sometimes that's because I want to serve the Lord in the most crazy way. But I want that fire back. And maybe some of you guys are like me where you had the fire and now you're just kind of surviving on embers. Or maybe you're somebody who doesn't have any embers or any fire yet, but you keep hearing about these obnoxious Christians that keep talking about being on fire for God or the love for God. And you're like, what I'm doing ain't working. I'm being bold for myself, but I need to be bold for something better. Now, so we're gonna jump into Ephesians 3, where Paul, the author of Ephesians, is talking about being bold. And Paul happens to be one of my favorite people in the Bible. Paul has this crazy past, and yet he can still stand confidently amongst people and never back down. We're going to be doing Ephesians chapter 3, verses 7 through 8. This is the part right before Paul preached a couple weeks ago about how grace doesn't just save you from hell, it saves you from the things that bind you. It frees you. This is right before that chunk right there. And we're not gonna dive super theologically into this because sometimes I feel like the simplest responses are what make the biggest changes in life. If there's truth, truth is truth, and let it sink in, and you can be free from those. And so we're just focusing on Paul's responses here. Ephesians 3, 7 through 8. I became a servant of this gospel by the gift of God's grace given me through the working of his power. And although I am less than the least of the Lord's people, this grace was given me to preach to the Gentiles the boundless riches of Christ. For those unaware, Paul has written 23% of the New Testament. Well, a lot of the New Testament that we read, especially Ephesians that we're going through right now, he's written that. And I feel like he writes a lot of stuff because he seems to be one of the few people who has this really solid grasp of what grace truly is. See, Paul went through a lot of things in his life, some of which we're going to jump into. And we'll just run through some of them real quick. Paul was lashed 5 separate times for 40 lashes by the Jews. He was beaten 3 times with rods. He was once pelted with rocks. He was shipwrecked 3 times. He was eventually martyred in Rome by being beheaded. These are the ones that I found numbers for. They're all over in there where he's been arrested numerous times. And as I'm reading these things, it blows my mind. How can Paul be beaten, have everybody hate him, stand so strong and so bold? Because I can tell you what, when finances are minimal, I'm not feeling so bold. I'm wondering, where are you, God? When I don't have that girlfriend that I've been looking for a really long time, and I'm like, God, I'm getting old, I'm 33. I know that's funny for some. I feel old, okay? I wonder, God, where are you? And sometimes it makes me a little less bold. Because Paul realizes something in here that I sometimes forget to realize myself. If we just focus on that first line, verse 7, I became a servant for this gospel by the gift of God's grace given me through the working of his power. He recognizes right off the bat, first of all, this is an introduction. He's introducing himself. And if you guys have ever met somebody, you realize an introduction tells you more about a person right off the bat than you'll probably get out of them in the first 30 minutes. Hi, my name is Dr. So-and-so. Okay, they're a doctor. They have a title. This is important to them. Or, hi, I'm so-and-so. I'm this person's husband. I'm this person's wife. I do this for work. Usually, if that is attached to their introduction, you can tell that is important to them. They want that to be part of what defines them. Paul, he's jumping in right off the bat. He says, hey, my name is Paul, and I'm a what? I'm a servant of the gospel, a slave for the gospel. This isn't something I was kidnapped and forced to do. This is something I am choosing to do. When somebody comes up to me and they say, are you a Christian? A lot of the times the response is, yes, I'm a Christian. I can't ever remember a time I said, yes, I'm a Christian. I serve the Lord. Not only do I not state that, but even though I verbally might say, I serve the Lord, my actions show I believe the Lord serves me. Because if I'm coming to God and I say, God, where are you with those finances? It's not me asking, God, please come through on those finances. It's God, where are you on this? Why aren't you helping me through this health situation? Why aren't you doing this? The question is, why aren't we finding ways to serve Lord through the Lord through these situations? And I believe that Paul has such a strong understanding of grace because the very first thing he does is he recognizes the authority of the Lord. He stands right there and he says, God, you are before me and I serve you. You do not serve me. We have to realize that if we are ever going to understand the grace. Because if we feel that it's earned, it's not grace. If we feel that it is given freely, it's a gift and it's something we can hold on to. The other thing Paul talks about is the grace given him through the power of God. Again, this comes from God. There is nothing you can do to earn this grace. This fire that you want to rekindle inside of you does not come from you. It comes from God and God alone. And that comes from serving the Lord. And that fire will ignite. The other thing that he talks about is the grace itself. And I have to ask, why does Paul need grace? Some of us have crazy testimonies. Some of us have been through hell and back. Others of us have had a pretty easy life. Other than bullying, my life was pretty great. I had 2 parents that loved me. I had support at home. I did pretty well in school. I didn't have any abuse in my life. So then I have to sit here and I have to think, why do I need grace? I haven't done that many crazy things. Well, if Paul needs grace, I must need grace too, so let's figure out why he needs grace. If you guys go through Acts 9, which we aren't going to go through, I'm going to summarize it for you because we'll be here all day, you get the story of the conversion of Paul. Except Paul wasn't always Saul. Or sorry, Paul wasn't always Paul. Paul was Saul. He was this guy who studied, and I'm going to get it wrong, but he studied under this Jewish teacher named Gamaliel. I think I said that right. And Gamaliel was the guy you wanted to study under. There were rabbis all over the place that students could go and study from, but if you had a choice, you were going to go to Gamaliel. He knew the laws forwards, backwards. He knew the prophecies forwards and backwards. He knew everything there was to know about Jewish law, and he was righteous and a borderline extremist. So when you are an extremist, you're kind of passing down that extremist view, and Saul absorbed it all. And Saul started to think when Jesus came onto the scene and then died and people started to become Christians. These Christians are preventing the Jewish prophecies from moving forward. These Christians are perverting the Jewish faith. I cannot have that. So he took it upon himself to kill Christians. He took it upon himself to drag them before the courts and make them renounce their faith. Anything less than being a Jew who followed the faith religiously was not acceptable. It even says that in Stephen, the very first Christian martyr, the very first person to be stoned for the Christian faith, it says that Saul sat in the back holding the clothes of those that were stoning Stephen. He was present at that very first one. Saul eventually decided he was going to make one big push. He was headed to Damascus. He's got court papers saying he can drag Christians out of the synagogues. He is going to kill them or at least get them to renounce their faith. On his way to Damascus, Jesus comes down. He says, "Saul, why are you persecuting me?" Strikes him blind right there. This guy went from a guy who had everything. People knew his name. He probably had some money. People feared him. And he was bold in himself. But here Jesus comes and he strikes him blind, and now he is reliant on other people. How he's going to go to the bathroom, where he's going to go, what is going to happen, he doesn't know, but life can't keep going on the way that it was. And after Jesus having the stern talk with him, Ananias comes down and Saul converts to Christianity and becomes Paul. He is now bold, not in himself any longer, but he is now bold in Christ. And that is why he becomes one of the greatest people, in my opinion, in the New Testament. That's why he felt such a passion to become or to write 23% of the Bible. He understood grace because he understood what he was saved from. If we go into verse 8, it says, "Although I am less than the least of all the Lord's people, this grace was given me." We're going to stop right there. Although I am less than the least of the Lord's people, if somehow we could line everybody up in the world based on the Lord's people, the best people over here and the worst people over here, Paul is saying, I'm at the end of the very least. Why is he doing that? Aren't all lives equal? Doesn't God forgive all sins? So how is it that Paul is the least of these people? Because he remembers where he came from. He's not putting value on it necessarily. He's just saying, I remember where I came from. In fact, even in the other parts of the Bible, it talks about, I am the least of these because I persecuted the Lord. And he's saying, I don't deserve this grace, but I accept it. But I'm going to stay back here where I can fully appreciate where I came from. He doesn't let it ever define him. He doesn't introduce himself as Paul, formerly Saul, who killed Christians. I'm sorry. He says, I'm Paul, and I'm a servant of the Lord. Not only am I a servant of the Lord, I'm the least of all the servants. Some of us have come from crazy backgrounds, and the Lord has saved us. If you guys ever want to see this in action, find the person in the church who seems to understand grace the best. Okay, I've met at least five, and I love talking to all of you, but I know about five people in this church, and it just seems like they understand grace so much more than the average person. And when I talk to them, and I ask about their testimony, and they give me little bits and pieces, I realize, whoa, they were a person who had nothing to lose. Take their material objects. Take their reputation. Take anything, because it doesn't even amount to anything, because now they have grace. They have the Lord, and now they have everything and nothing all at the same time. So I have to remember, because I want that fire in my life. I want to go back to that internship day where that fire wasn't just coals, but there were flames busting out of it, and I want that. But I have to be willing to do two things, according to Paul in his very beginning. I have to stand before the Lord, and I have to recognize his authority in my life. Because when I forget that, either I or somebody else becomes the authority in my life, and nobody really knows what they're doing in those situations. The other thing I have to do is I have to remember. I will not let those things define me. I will not let the bad things that have happened to me define me. But I will remember them, because those are motivators to keep you going. The farther you get away from there, the better. But when you start backtracking because you've forgotten, you could wind up right back there. We need to become people that are bold for the Lord. We have to stop being bold in ourselves. And that's going to look different. For me, it comes out as an obnoxious boldness. For some people, that comes as a grumpy boldness. For some people, that's religious boldness. For some people, fill in the blank, you know yourself. And we can definitely tell when there's a difference between being bold in ourselves and being bold in the Lord. Because usually when we're bold in the Lord, it's selfless and there's fruit. When we're bold in ourselves, there's not that. I'm going to have the worship team come on up. It's interesting that Paul killed Christians because they weren't Jewish. So pretty much he was killing the Gentiles. But when he became Paul, what was the assignment that God gave him? Go and preach to the Gentiles. Same people you're killing. It kind of blew my mind. There's that TV show that they just redid. At first they redid it. It was a mini-series about the Old Testament. And then they went and redid the New Testament. And I've read through the Bible a couple times, so I know these stories. And sometimes they can get very repetitive. But one thing struck me was I was watching as Paul is blind and he's in this barn, so to speak. And then Ananias comes and he converts. And then Ananias is like, hey, let's go meet everybody else. You're welcome in our family. And then he shows up and all the Christians are like, what the heck is he doing here? I mean, take the worst religious person you could possibly think of, or terrible, I mean, there's some world leaders out there that killed minorities or specific people, right? Imagine that person converted and then you just invited them after they converted. It would be awkward. There would be not a whole lot of trust. So it would take boldness for us to stand. It would take courage for us to know that even if we don't feel it, we belong here. And we need to find that family that can help us be bold. I'm going to take this opportunity. We're just going to have a moment of silence. I welcome any of you who want to come kneel before the cross up here on the stage. You can feel free to do that. If you'd like to sit or stand or find somewhere else in the room where you want to pray and do you, that's totally fine. But I'd like you to focus on those two things, because one of them needs more work than the other, more than likely. Are you allowing God to be the authority in your life, or have you been living as the authority to God? And how's that working out for you? Are you remembering where you came from? And are you remembering that freely? Or are you remembering that with shackles and chains because you're letting it define you still? Come before the Lord. Let grace set you free, not because you've earned it, because it's given to you by the Lord. You guys just take this minute. You can come forward now. Let's just bow our heads and pray for a little bit.